Welcome to the 8th Annual Homelessness Marathon, a national dialogue on homelessness and poverty in America. The toll-free call-in number for this broadcast is 1-877-NOBODY-8. That's the word nobody, followed by the number 8. Or if you're currently, recently, or about to be homeless, you may also call 1-866-LEFT-OUT. Our nation's capital occupies a place in the imagination of every American, but it's not an imaginary place. It's a city with real streets and real homeless people our real lawmakers drive past when they pass real laws. We'll note that there's no global warming in Washington and ask why homeless people are out in the cold right after this.
Poetry is the breath of emotion, and emotion is the strength of adolescence. Homeless teens express their emotions through poetry.
Jason Bather, teen poet, reads his first poem, which is untitled.
In a lush, lost, forgotten garden of nowhere, he wept in pain. His eyes scattered blood across the golden blades of grass covering a once famined land. His mouth echoed across the earth to release a plague of locusts on a so-called innocence. His ears heard nothing but the pleading screams of agony from the youthful and naive. He tore his heart from an open wound in his chest, and like a cocoon, it tore open and released a small child with a porcelain face and empty blackened eye sockets. It grew before his eyes, mortified in terror. He strangled it until it laid still in the grass, and from the heavens, angels descended to devour its corpse, and the world was destroyed. This is called Small Child Lost in a Sea of People. Burn your safety blanket. Stray from your mother. Unconscious search for an inappropriate lover. Small child in a sea of people. Prowler ready to abduct. Raped and killed, you obviously don't give a damn. You're such a good parent crying on the news. Should've watched your kid a little better. I blessed waste-filled eyes sitting on a throne of lost memories. Tightened restriction strangles the last haunting thoughts of suffering. Tragic prose left to hang in the winds of trauma. Sadly beaten into submission, I wait for the day to strike back at a world of hate. Another so-called disgusting reaction to settle a horrid and grotesque period of attacks. Slowly slipping away, I cannot wait.
What I don't want to hear. By Shauna. Tell me that I'm beautiful if you think that will make everything all right. Keep assuring me I have it all if you think that'll stop me from crying tonight. Tell me that I'm sweet and everyone likes me the old way. Remind me that I'm talented as if that'll make everything all okay. Tell me I'm rich, I can have anything I want. Bribe me with the material, but inside I have nothing to flaunt. If you think this is what I want to hear, you've missed the latest notice. I'm never getting better, even if I promise.
Purpose by Xander Blake. This life can't be all that exists. There must be something more out there. Amongst the rubble of forsaken humanity, a single spot of life catches my eye. Long-lost memories flood my cerebrum. Remembering the better days, days when being different was a good thing. Those days have ceased to be. They have faded into the recesses of the darkened alleyways of time, never to be reawakened by everyone, endlessly chasing them through the downward spiral. My life has been hard, though not as hard as some, but when looked at in the backwash of the neon-lit memory, I've come to realize that I'm no worse off than anyone else. So maybe I'm homeless. It isn't such a big deal to me. I'm not the only one with problems, nor will I be the last person with them. As long as parents keep ignoring their offspring, the value of life will continue to degrade, once more causing strife among those who seek change, a change that will never see the light of day. So heed my words as I speak to you. Not everything is meant to be good, but trust that you are put here for some purpose, a purpose that will someday make the world a better place for all.
Untitled by Jenna. It grows, it swells, it separates, it overtakes us, it engulfs us, it is more. We are less, nothing, empty without it. It tastes, it smells, strawberries and warm, hot cocoa. It's here, all around us. It lives in my red and orange sugar bowl. It hides in my bathroom sink. He gave it to me, and I gave him more back. It tickles us. It whispers in our ears. It breathes heavy and pulsating as we make love. It rises. It falls. It is true. Red and green swirl to make pure unity. Excitement, longing, hope, run, dance, pace, swim, sing, collide, unite, belong, overcome, breathe, hurt, ignite, hurry, exhale, conjoin, gather, realize, love.
Hi, everybody. It's me, Nobody, and welcome to the 12th hour of the 8th Annual Homelessness Marathon, where the numbers to call in are 877-NOBODY-8. That's the word nobody and the number 8. Or if you're homeless, formerly homeless, or afraid you're about to be homeless, you may also call 866-LEFT-OUT. This hour, we're going to talk about Washington, D.C., which, without putting too fine a point on it, is the home to two very diverse populations. You have a lot of wealthy white politicians and a lot of poor black people. I know that's oversimplifying it. But we're going to talk to people who have dealt with both. On the line, I have with me Brad Paul, who is the director of the National Policy and Advocacy Council on Homelessness, and Tom Gomez, who is the co-founder of Mayday DC. Tom and Brad, welcome to the Homelessness Marathon.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning, and thank you.
All right. Well, let me start with you, Brad. Now, you deal with advocacy. When you advocate for policies for homeless people, have you ever had occasion to go up to Congress or and lobby directly?
Oh, yeah. Quite a bit of time, as a matter of fact.
And when you go to Congress, do all those senators and representatives there, do they say, oh, it's our friend Brad. Brad, come on in because we want to talk to you. What can we do next to help homeless people?
Not sure that's quite the reception that that I can usually expect. I wouldn't say that homelessness is on the top of too many members of Congress's priority list.
Well, where would you say it is?
Let's say somewhere sort of towards the bottom.
Okay. And so do you find yourself talking a lot of the time to congressmen and senators who are hostile to you or clueless on the issue? What kind of things do you encounter?
Well, let's be clear. I mean, there's certainly some allies on the Hill and folks who want to do something about the issue. But getting it on their radar screen is challenge number one. And two, there is some hostility in the sense that we're playing this zero-sum game with the budget in D.C. And the feeling is that we can't on the Hill that we can't fund social programs, housing programs, healthcare assistance, things of that nature, given the budget deficit, given the war, given the tax cuts. So it's a matter of trying to get our issue on the priority list, and that's a challenge. And I think there's some goodwill on the Hill, but there's a lot of work to be done to get folks to prioritize this.
Mm. Now, Tom, you work on, I guess, the other end of the spectrum. You're an organizer among poor people, really.
Yes, I'm the other end of the spectrum. I was homeless for the first time myself when I was 10, and I've been in and out of homelessness for much of my adult life. Mm-hmm. Mayday DC is not a group of paid professionals, but a group of community activists, many of whom were homeless themselves or are homeless now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you were recently involved, I know, in a housing takeover. Can you tell people about that?
Well, I wasn't recently involved in the most recent of the housing takeovers. I did the Franklin School takeover in 2002.
Okay.
And the group did the takeover of the Randall Shelter, which is closed downtown. People should know that Washington, D.C. is not only the capital of the nation, it's the nation's capital in terms of homelessness. 3% of our population is homeless. 17,000 adults were homeless for at least part of the year last year, and about 9,000 are homeless on any given night. That includes 1,200 children under the age of 5. a huge amount of money has come into the district under the Williams administration. And they've
Williams is the mayor.
Yes, Anthony Williams is the mayor here. And he's focused on getting new investment into the city and has done that. The problem has become that we have gone from 11% of our population being homeless in 2000 to over 13% now. That's an increase of close to 20%, and the city's response to that increase is not to create more services, but to cut existing services, to close services downtown and try to push the homeless away from the center of the city. You can't fix it, hide it.
Mm-hmm. Those numbers again here on the Homelessness Marathon to call in on are 877-NOBODY-8 or 866-LEFT-OUT. Now, lest anyone miss the connection, Tom, the city you're describing with all these poor homeless people is the city that the rich Congress people drive through to get to Congress to do their nefarious work.
But the problem is not simple. Homeless people have nothing in common with each other except for the fact that they don't earn much money,
right,
and don't have housing. So you have a continuum of people ranging from people who are dual diagnosed, who have mental illness and substance abuse,
mm-hmm,
who may have on top of that learning disabilities, and no family connections, all the way to people who are fairly educated and articulate.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no one-size-fits-all answer.
No, I'm not claiming that there is, but the point is, do you think it is possible, Tom, for the people in Congress who make the laws to be completely unaware of the conditions in Washington, D.C., where they're going to work every day?
No, people are aware. Joel Siegel, who's an aide to Congressman John Conyers, helped to write the Bring America Home Act, and he's
right,
a former director of a shelter in North Carolina. And that legislation, which is fairly comprehensive, promises to end homelessness. The problem is the price tag, $156 billion. And that means there's very little interest in doing that in the Hill, especially right now, in a time when George Bush is promising to use troops to bring freedom around the world.
Well, I pointed this out earlier on the program, and it's worth repeating. If we had stayed at the Carter levels of funding for home housing funds in the United States, instead of cutting them in more than half from Reagan and on, we would have spent $500 or $600 billion on housing that we did not spend because of those cuts. So it is worth noting that even the most ambitious plan in Congress proposes to spend only at most about a quarter of what was cut to create the problem.
Well, of course, Republicans attacked that last year, the Ford administration, we saw 400,000 new units of subsidized housing created. Last year, just over 35,000 Section 8 vouchers for the Housing Choice Program were given out. And a good portion of those were returned because the people who received them couldn't find anywhere they wanted to rent to them. And that the higher levels of spending were attacked under the Reagan administration as not being effective. And certainly we had less homelessness. So I tend to dispute that it wasn't effective.
Well, you know, if you were a construction person and somebody said, is that a load-bearing wall or can we kick it out? And you kicked it out and the whole building collapsed, you might suspect, yes, it actually was a load-bearing wall. They kicked out these programs, and now there's, you know, hundreds of thousands of people on the streets. That just might be a clue. That'd be my humble opinion.
Yeah, it's also the way we carried forward deinstitutionalization, also under Reagan. The Mental Patients Liberation Front, of course, fought for the deinstitutionalization of people suffering from mental illness, won at the Supreme Court. That was carried forward in a really healthy way in places like Vermont. In other places, you close the hospital and deinstitutionalize to the street.
Yeah, yeah. Brad, so there should be no misunderstanding. Am I clear on this? My understanding is that at one point the National Coalition for the Homeless fell on hard times and had to cut its political staff, and NPAC, your organization, was founded because the staff was so dedicated they were willing to work without money, without nothing, just to keep the whole thing going and struggle to try and keep a political presence for homeless people in Washington.
Yeah, that's right. I was the director of policy at the National Coalition from 2001 to 2003. And as you just said, the coalition experienced difficult financial times, as many organizations throughout the country are experiencing as well, and laid off its policy staff December 2003. That group then formed into NPAC, so we're about a year and a half old right now to continue that work, including work on what Tom had talked about a little bit, Bringing America Home Act. There was a real feeling among staff that there was some unfinished business, and that in order to carry out some of that more progressive legislation on the Hill, we would need to form into a new entity.
So it would not be correct to think of NPAC as fat cats there working the Hill.
I certainly hope not. No.
Yeah, but let's take a step back, too.
Okay.
Because what happens with homeless people is that you wind up in this separate homeless world where nobody is interested in your ascension out of that world, only in managing a crisis.
Yeah.
People are not developed to become things like policy analyst at the advocacy group. They are developed to be things like bouncer in the soup kitchen, frontline staff at the shelter. The guy comes in, he's drunk, he's violent, he's got a knife. Wrestle him out. The people who deal with the rich white politicians are other middle-class white people who come from very similar backgrounds.
Now, is that
true, all of the money is going into middle-class white people.
Brad, is that your impression?
That homeless advocates are by and large middle class white people.
Yeah.
Well, let me step back a second. I mean, I'm a middle class white person, but let me step back a little bit to the premise that Tom's work and our work operates on different ends of the spectrum. I mean, I think it's critical to talk about the linkages between folks who are working in the front lines and the folks who are trying to articulate, to some extent, those positions on the Hill for progressive change. Tom had mentioned the Bringing America Home Act. It's a piece of legislation that I worked on quite intimately with Joel Siegel on the Hill. And those proposals within that piece of legislation came from working directly with folks on the front line, listening to the stories of what's happening in local communities, and trying to craft that into a piece of legislation that can help address the crisis, not only in places like D.C., but throughout the country, including smaller communities, rural communities, mid-sized cities. Mm-hmm. I mean, what Tom has described for D.C. can apply equally to many cities throughout this country. It's not just a D.C. phenomenon.
Tom, do you have a gripe with MPAC? I mean, I kind of sense a kind of resentment there. What is it you're trying to say?
What I'm trying to say is that very often, if you look at facilities like CCEDV, the Community for Creative Nonviolent Shelter houses 700
right.
men. Later this morning, I'm going to go to the Zacchaeus Kitchen. It's been there since 1978. Some of the men I'll see there have been in that kitchen, eating in the kitchen since 1978. And there seems to be little interest in developing a political leadership out of the afflicted community. I don't know whether that's intentional or not, but there's another activist who's based in New York, Kai Lumumba-Barrow, and she's the wife of Ashante Austin. And one of the things she does is consult with agencies on diversity. And she consulted with a very big progressive nonprofit whose name I won't mention because they'll probably feel that my criticism is unfair. But they were wondering, why don't they have more involvement from their client base in terms of really being active on issues? And she said, well, are you really developing people from within that base to take over the positions you hold?
Well, maybe the whole premise is wrong, though, Tom, because there are organizations like what you're describing. Mayday DC is one. The Kensington Welfare Rights Union, we just had Sherry Hunkel on. She's a homeless woman who organized this. People who are organizing tent cities around the country and stuff. I mean, there is leadership from within the homeless community. I'm just not sure it comes from the top down developing leaders. I think it comes when homeless people take the reins in their own hands.
Well, if you look at the squatter movement in New York, for
there you go. There's
the
a good 80s. Example.
I was part of that movement
Frank Morales was on earlier from that movement as well.
Yeah, it was part of that movement where the squatter was the squatter, the advocate, the protester. You were all the different parts. You fixed the building. You demonstrated in the street. You wrote whatever needed to be written about it. And if you look at the outcome of that, 20 years later, where 500 units of housing have been created that people own, they have equity. And look at that compared to what's done in a lot of things that have been much better funded. The squatter movement had no funding for 20 years.
Right.
Now, many of these other groups, no matter how progressive they are, have had a great deal of funding come in over the last 20 years, but the clients they serve often are, well, sometimes not much better of a situation than they were before.
Yeah. Well, all right. It's
certainly
an interesting question.
Certainly the development of equity.
It's an interesting question. I wish I had more time to go into it, but we got people who want to get in on this conversation, so I want to make sure to open it up to them. And let's start. Those numbers are 877-NOBODY-8 or 866-LEFT-OUT. We have Hector from Inglewood, California on the phone. Oh, in fact, it says here on my thing, on my screen here, you're a physician and you're running for the mayor of Los Angeles.
Yes, I am.
Welcome to the marathon.
Buenas noches.
Buenas noches.
Buenas noches.
Well, I'm interested in hearing both of you or all of you, because I came to be left out on different circumstances, and I would like to share how you can also be left out. It's due to the Patriot Act, you know. I was a fellow at the King Drew Medical Center. I was placed, a lien was placed on me, and without a lawyer, and with a lien, you can't even qualify for public housing. You realize that, right? Mm-hmm. And so it seems to me very perverse that there's plenty of houses. I know because I received plenty of offers to buy houses, but without credit, you're left out. So I think the mayor of Mr. Hahn, who is somehow involved in so much scandalous corruption, that it's now a fact, all these people realize what is going on here.
Hector, can you tell us how you're running? Are you running on one of the parties? Are you running as
well? No, the point is, how could I run without credit? It's obviously absurd, but I'm saying officially, I am in the list of 22 people who are running against Mayor Hahn, and we don't get to hear about all these people.
Okay. All right. And so what would you say about what's going on in Washington, D.C. in terms of policy, which is sort of what we're trying to make a little bit the focus of this now? What would you bring to Los Angeles if you were a politician in charge?
You're asking me?
Yeah.
Well, I think there ought to be a very intense interest to somehow lift out so many restrictions and preferential treatment to those who have a hard time establishing a legitimate credit with this Patriot Act.
Mm-hmm. You raise a horribly important issue because, of course, Hope 6 has been phased out now. But a number of sites of the district are still targeted for redevelopment under Hope 6. That means they're going to make them nicer. It also means they're going to move about two-thirds of the people who live there now out, and most of the remaining people will not be allowed to return. And one of the things that's looked at in whether or not you get to return to public housing when your public housing is targeted for Hope 6 redevelopment, which means it becomes mixed income. That doesn't mean they're going to raise any of your incomes. That means they're going to move in people who have more income than you and displace a lot of you outside of the city. Those who get to return are those who have credit. And not having credit is a function of being poor.
Now, there's another issue here that has to do with mental health. You know, I am a physician, and I resent the fact that many of these diagnoses, some of them, they're not legitimate. I've been diagnosed with schizophrenia. And just by one visit, some of these are physicians who are, so I don't know if they're being paid, you know, to simply people place them on this sort of list of disabilities. Some of these physicians are foreigners from Russia, and the fact that they don't speak Spanish, it really it makes me feel that this is a very troubling situation for many of those who buy into this notion that this is a very friendly mental health care system. I have written letters to Senator Kennedy, to President Bush, and to Arnold Schwarzenegger. Still, I have not yet received any response. And this is, I think, a fascist way of dealing with this, considering the book that it's out there called IBM and the Holocaust. And the one I'm talking about. Marginalize and eventually turn into a place where you can live in a ghetto and eventually simply gradually being exterminated by being sent into a mental health institution.
Well, stop right there, Hector. I want to ask Brad something. This is a point, I'm always amazed by all the things that come up, and there's never time for them all. But Brad, there are a lot of people who are concerned that we are moving, if we're not moving towards death camps, we're certainly, people are afraid we're moving towards concentration camps in this country. We're starting out with shelters, and maybe if there get to be more homeless people on the streets, we'll start to have, shall we say, planned communities with fences around them for them or something. I don't know what they'll call it. Is there anything going on in Washington that might justify this fear from what you've seen?
Well, I mean, that's a very strong analogy. I mean, I would say that where you started the conversation earlier about the declining HUD budget and then where Tom has picked up on a couple of points with Hope 6 is that what we do see is a pretty intensified class war going on in this country. And whether it's Hope 6 displacing folks into nowhere, not having the credit, not having the voucher, not being able to return to the mixed income housing that Tom has described, or whether it's a HUD budget that has a 25-year trend line that's going down, 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 including a recent budget that the president submitted, which is very grim. All of this sort of combines to create a sort of an exit to nowhere for folks on the streets. So I'm reluctant to cast it as a concentration camp, but I'm certainly very concerned about what's increasingly seeming to be a war on the poor.
Hector, I'm going to have to move on, but do you want to tell people your last name so they can vote for you?
Well, they cannot vote for me, but this is a symbolic gesture that I am a legitimate candidate.
Uh-huh.
And my last name is Beltran.
Beltran, Hector Beltran. Well, if you want to vote for Hector or even write in his name, Hector is definitely a candidate who wants to help homeless people, and I want to thank you very much, Hector, for contributing to the Homelessness Marathon.
Muchas gracias.
Thank you.
Before we move on from the point, though, I think Senor Beltran raised a very important point, which is culturally specific services.
Right.
We heard the governor of Maryland recently proclaim that Latinos need to learn English. There were no resources behind that claim for English language instruction for Latino immigrants who desperately want to learn English. There's a bill now that will make English the official language. So it becomes difficult for Latinos to even access the services. You cannot talk here in the district where 60% of the population is African-American and many in poverty, 37% illiteracy,
right,
about culturally specific services. Nobody's hearing you.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the riots came out of in the 1990s here in the Latino community. And in my opinion, we're still not much further. As a matter of fact, the Council of Latino Agencies, looking at the situation 10 years after the riots, issued a report that said very little progress has been made.
Mm. Those numbers to call in here on the Homelessness Marathon are 877-NOBODY-8 or 866-LEFT-OUT. In the Tower of Testimony, we have Chad. Is Chad there at the mic?
Yes, I'm here.
Chad, what would you like to say?
I want to bring up the reality of the shelters are run in New Haven, Connecticut, and possibly across the nation. There's lack of training for the staff that are running these shelters. Where therefore, it's making it much harder for the homeless to make ends meet in a shelter. There are rules and favoritism played on certain members of the homeless community that have been homeless for quite some time. So therefore, people that walk into this situation have to deal with that kind of bias treatment towards racial color, history of the client, so on and so forth. The shelters aren't really super clean. I mean, the Columbus House here, yes, it's a clean shelter, but the way the staff are running it, it's like a little prison camp. In the couple other shelters, see, I don't stay in shelters no more due to the fact of how the shelters are run and the cleanliness of the shelters. I sleep outside. Mm-hmm. And I'm clean. If you look at me now, I'm cleaner than most of the people that are walking out of this shelter right now. So, but anyways, the reality of shelters, it's really hard for the homeless people to survive in these shelters and be productive in their lives as far as finding employment, finding skills needed to better themselves to get out of this situation. Granted, there's some homeless people that don't want to get out of this situation, and those people are who they choose to be. I'm not in this situation. I need a hand up, not a handout.
Okay, Chad, can you hang on a second? I want to come back to you, but I got a note here. We got a homeless person from L.A. on the line who is on a cell phone and can't afford the minutes if we don't get them right on. So hang on. I don't know who the name of this person, but are you there? Hello?
Hello.
Yes, what's your name?
I'll just call myself Jean Valjean.
Okay, Jean, what's on your mind?
Just for people that are listening, that don't understand the homelessness situation at all, and they don't understand that people can get there. I'm an ex-commodity broker. I'm a United States Marine veteran, and I'm homeless and have been homeless for almost 2 years. You get into a situation where you don't meet this requirement because of some policy, and you can fall through the cracks. It can happen to anyone. I was doing fine for most of my life. I'm almost 60. I probably have 55 years of excellent life and a couple of years of having a little bit of a trouble. But once it starts falling apart, it falls apart so badly that it's really hard to crawl back on top. It seems like most of the programs that are in existence seem to be just perpetuating themselves, and they don't really help people. Here in Los Angeles, we have homeless shelters, but if you're trying to make a living, if you're trying to stay alive, if you're trying to work, pretty much can't get into one. I'm a busker. I play the guitar. I've been playing guitar for most of my life, and I've made a decent living at it for most of my life. But to get into a shelter in Los Angeles, you have to... At 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock, be standing somewhere to be picked up, to be taken to a shelter, and you don't know where that shelter is going to be. You don't know if you can get out from it. And it pretty much means that you can't work that evening or late that afternoon because you have to give up the idea of working in order to be sheltered.
Right, because of their requirements, you're saying.
Yeah.
Well, this jives with exactly what Chad was saying. Chad, is this your experience? Is it hard if you're in a shelter to hold a job at the same time?
Yes. Yes. But you know, that it's not so much my experience. They wake you up in the morning for a job and so on and so forth. But the tough part about it is having the clean clothes, having the use of a phone is what you need, and the plain fact that some bosses don't want to deal with somebody coming out of home instead of staying at a shelter.
Yeah, I understand. People don't understand out there that, you know, if you go to a shelter, it's not like you've got a room and you've got dresser drawers and you got a place. You have a very regimented life. You got to be in. They throw you out at certain hours, and you're not allowed to be in.
Exactly.
Well, one of the problems of being homeless is just the documentation. If you're lucky enough to have a place to where you get mail, that's terrific, because you know most of notifications that you get to report for this and for that. And that's wonderful if you have a place to get mail.
Right.
In my case, I was lucky enough to get a post office box. But you know what? When you're on the road, you don't have a Rolodex to put that information in. You don't have a folder. And you know, you're carrying all this crap stuff with you on your back, and you know, you lose pieces of paper. And you miss appointments, and they think that you're unreliable, and you may be very reliable. You just don't have a good system.
Tell me about it. I just recreated my ID after 2 years. Every office kept sending me to another office saying, you don't have a birth certificate.
I've been bounced around. I have been bounced around from one place to another. Somebody earlier said that there's no real advocacy, and it's true. They don't help you. All they do is they defuse the situation for 5 or 10 minutes or an hour or for a day or whatever.
Yep, exactly.
And then they say, go talk to these people. And so you go over there and you spend the entire day waiting around, and then you find out you don't qualify because you're not an alcoholic, or you don't qualify because you're not a drug addict.
Exactly.
And also if you need medical care.
It's
a whole other problem. Listen, I want to thank you. I know, Jean, that you haven't got many minutes, so I really want to thank you for spending your precious minutes talking to us.
Bless your heart, man. I just want to thank you for having this, because people really don't know what's going on, and I don't wish this on anyone.
You're so right, John.
I wish there were some way that people could understand this without having to experience it.
Yeah.
But I don't know that there is a way.
Well, I want to thank you.
We don't have a coming police state for the homeless. We already have a police state.
Oh, we already have it. Yeah. Well, can I say something real fast?
Sure.
All right, real fast. Everybody that's listening that has a job and that has a home, when you get home from work, okay, the first thing that you want to do is you want to get comfortable. So you want to change out of your business clothes to your to your casual clothes. All right, if I do that in the street, I'll get arrested.
You don't need it.
All right, then you go to the refrigerator. You might want to get yourself a beer or a glass of wine or something like that. If I do that, I get arrested. All right, after a while, you have to go to the bathroom. So you go to the bathroom. I can't do that, because if I do that, I'll get arrested. It's against the law to be poor. It's against the law to be homeless. And that is the crime. The crime is sad.
Okay,
anyway,
thank you very much, John. I very much appreciate
it.
Listen, you gave me also, John, a chance, if you're listening still, to say something. Every year I say this, and I haven't gotten it in yet. When a canary dies in a coal mine, it's not a veterinary problem. And if homeless people are suffering, it is not just a problem for homeless people, because what is hurting the homeless people is going to hurt us all.
Society.
It is the same reason people are homeless is the same reason people can't get medical care. Their pensions are being eviscerated. People who are working are not getting enough money. It's the same reason why scholarships are disappearing from our universities. It's all part of the same thing. It's not just about homeless people. Chad, have you got a last comment you want to make?
I noticed that this is a national problem, which is it makes me feel a little bit better knowing that it's not just Connecticut. And I feel as though the mayor of New Haven, Connecticut, John DeStefano, can step up and help out his city much better than what he's been doing as far as the homeless advocacy and helping people out with the housing. And
I didn't catch that. Are you saying he's good or bad?
He's bad.
Okay.
All right. And also,
that was clear.
A lot of money is being put into homelessness, allocated for homelessness. Where is that money going? And why is, as a homeless person, I don't see this money trickling down to our level as homeless, you know? It gets as far as the shelters, and what they do with the money, I have no clue.
Okay, thank you very much.
The bigger the crisis, the bigger the bureaucracy, the more middle-class, college-educated people there are with houses and cars.
I must say, Tom, I do not share your antipathy towards people who have houses, but who are middle-class. But nonetheless, Brad, let me ask you this. I've never met anybody who thought shelters were the answer. Not even the people who run shelters. I had a couple on earlier, including the person who runs Columbus House, where we are. Nobody thinks that shelters are the answer. But I'm wondering, in Congress, do they think shelters are the answer? Do you meet people in Congress who think we're doing enough, we're doing a lot? Do they think, well, look at everything we're doing and what we're providing? Is that an attitude you might find in the halls of government?
Well, absolutely. It's all they know for many of them, because what we have is a homeless emergency response system at the federal level, and precious little else. Both your caller there, Gene and Chad, both raised a good point about the grim realities of shelter life, and yet what we do every year in Congress is appropriate about $1 billion a year that's going to feed emergency shelters, social service programs, transitional housing, but nothing to get at the root causes, which is the affordable housing crisis. So each year, Congress looks at the budget. They determine that about $1 billion is going to go to homeless assistance without connecting that to the larger structural issues, which you just talked about a few minutes ago. I mean, this isn't about just homelessness. It's about a larger systems breakdown. And folks on the Hill are very reluctant to talk about the relationship between tax cuts and homelessness, the relationship between military spending. I mean, there's no discussion about general inequity in our housing system. But rather just sort of camping out on the shelter grants each year as the solution. So we're kidding ourselves, and folks on the Hill are kidding themselves when they talk about, quote-unquote, ending homelessness when they're looking at about $1 billion program every year to fund shelters and a few other slots of permanent housing.
Let me ask you this, Brett, because, you know, you've said there's some good guys in Congress, and I certainly know that there are. But for the rest of them, would you say they are A, educable, B, pressurable, or C, it's just a matter of throwing the bums out?
Probably a little bit of all three. Mm-hmm. Some of those are longer-term prospects, particularly when we talk about education. There's a reluctance to talk about class in this country, and that certainly includes folks on the Hill. Pressure has certainly got.
I think we've lost Brad. I don't know what happened. So, Tom, are you still there? Tom, are you there? Well, I guess we've lost everybody. But those numbers to call in here are 877-NOBODY-8 or 866-LEFT-OUT. And at the microphone, we have Lawrence. And Lawrence, is it possible? Can you hear me, Lawrence?
Yes, I can.
Well, we got somebody. Lawrence, welcome to the Homelessness Marathon. What would you like to say?
First of all, my name is Lawrence Hart. We know that people become homeless because of different situations. I recently became disabled St. Valentine's Day last year. And I had some people helping me, taking care of me, but they couldn't do it for a long period of time, so I ended up in the shelter. The shelter, as far, I can only speak about the shelters here in New Haven. The shelters, as far as I'm concerned in New Haven, they're really not. They're trying to do things, but they're not all that they're cracked up to be in the public. There are little things, discouraging things. Like sometimes I find myself coming in the shelter at 4 o'clock, and number one, they make you stand outside where the traffic can go down. Everybody going down the street can look at all these people in the line. And know that you're homeless, which is like a stigma as far as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. And then you go inside, you might be in a good mood, But when you come in there, the staff talks to you like you're a third-class citizen, and you can't speak back or say anything, or they threaten to put you on this DD list. And you're always under some kind of pressure in there. There's also, in my particular case, in everybody else's case, they need housing. And it doesn't seem to be enough housing here in New Haven. I signed up at the Housing Authority, the city of New Haven, and they put me on the list, and then I found out my number on the list was number 598. I have medical problems, and I don't even believe I'll be alive if I wait that long to have some place to live and use the medical machines that I need to use, the breathing apparatus, mm-hmm. apparatus and stuff like that. The shower facilities are fair, but they give you instead of giving you a towel, they give you a third of a towel, which is like a washcloth. I read in the 90-day stay policy that they had a token program where they would give you tokens for transportation. I've yet to see any tokens. So there's a lot of things that they have written down there that they're actually not doing. But like Chad, I was homeless once before, and I felt so uncomfortable being in the shelter that I went and bought a tent, and I started living out in the street in the tent, pitching the tent someplace, like a lot of other people are doing. And it's really a difficult situation here. I don't know exactly what can be done, but I know that they need to choose some better staff, staff that will be able to deal with people, and not discourage people from going out and trying to help themselves. Everybody says that most of the people in the shelters are on substance abuse, you know. But
Lawrence, let me ask you a question.
Yes,
because it's something I've actually spoken about a lot. Yes. Not tonight. You've said that the way people look at you and treat you, that can hurt you.
Oh yes, especially like if you go out for a job interview, they're always stressing you. You go out and get a job. You go out for a job interview, and the people at the job ask you for your telephone number, so they can get in touch with you. And so I'm fortunate enough to have a cell phone myself, which makes it is a useful tool for a homeless person, but. They'll call the shelter, and the people at the shelter, they'll be yelling at people inside the shelter, and they talk to the people that are calling up trying to hook you up with a job. They'll talk to them in such a nasty way that these people automatically they don't want to accept you for anything.
Okay,
job.
Lawrence, let me ask you this then: people can, if they're nasty to you, that hurts.
Yes.
If a person is kind to you, treats you like a human being.
Yes.
Does that make you feel better? Does that help?
Of course, if I come in at night and I'm in a good mood and I can continue to have that good mood, then I can sit down and try to prepare for the moves that I'm going to make tomorrow to try to get out of the homeless situation.
Yeah.
But once I come in and they start yelling at me and threatening me with DDs and I haven't done anything wrong, my whole attitude is messed up. Not only attitude messed up, but other people inside the shelter, their attitudes are messed up too, and you get in arguments with other people inside the shelter.
Lawrence, this is the point that I'm getting to, which is, people who are in houses will say to me, people who are, or anybody might say to me, we're so powerless. What can we do? And one of the things I say to them is, homeless people will tell you, if you look at them funny and you look at them like they're less than you, you hurt them. If you look at them with kindness, you help them. So you got enough power just to control how you look at people, so you got some power.
I agree with that.
Okay. That's why I was asking you.
Yes.
All right, America, this man, Lawrence, endorses my thesis. And therefore, I think I'm right.
We have another gentleman here that would like to say a few things.
Okay, let's hear him. Thank you, Lawrence. Okay, the gentleman at the mic, what's your name?
Bernard.
Bernard, welcome to the Homelessness Marathon. What's on your mind, Bernard?
I wanted to touch up on a few things, but my buddy Lawrence... He just about touched everything, but like he was saying, it's a positive atmosphere. It makes you, you know what I mean, brushing up your skills a little something. You know, and like he said, just look forward for the other day so you can just go out there and really sell yourself to try and get some kind of housing, you know what I mean? Because there's a lot of resources out there that the staff doesn't give us. we have to go out there in the cold, go to all these different, you know what I mean, organizations trying to get help, which your case manager is supposed to be providing you that help. You know what I mean? Their so-called got a job development where they don't send you a no job interviews because they have no tokens.
Mm-hmm.
And they somewhat come up with some kind of plan just to, you know, feed you just a little bit. But when you get to that ending of your time, where is you going to go after that? You got no job skills. They need better adequate training, far as the staff can train other staff, far as verbal and, you know, social comments to mm-hmm. each other. You know what I mean? They think negative about us because we're homeless. But at one time, a lot of these staffs was homeless too. They right. was on the same road right. we was on. Now they get a different position, and they look at us like it was never in our position before. So now we need for them to understand us like we understood them when they was in a situation, when we was in a situation. So now, I mean, it's a double standard now. So we trying to find some kind of way so we can just sit down and just come with, you know what I mean, some kind of solution, you know, to settle the plan, because the plan is not working. We got to change the whole plan. I mean, now if you look at the shelters, there are more younger people in the shelters than older people.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you very much, Bernard, for sharing that.
All right.
Thank you very much. Thank you. We've got our co-host back on the line. Brad, let me ask you a question. You, since you know the people in Congress, what percentage of the, what have we got, 535 people in Congress and Senate, what percentage would you say are really on board for a really problem-solving approach to homelessness and poverty? What percentage would you say are kind of, you know, well, tepid, but they might do something? And what percentage would you say, maybe from my point of view, even if you wouldn't use the word, are pretty much hopeless?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the only thing we have to go by is are their voting records on bills of relevance. And the Bringing America Home Act finished last Congress with 57 co-sponsors in the House. So that'd be, I guess, about a, if I'm doing the math correctly, about
12%, something like that?
Something like that, yeah. National Housing Trust Fund legislation, which is a piece of the puzzle on the solution, finished with 214 co-sponsors. So I do think there's some momentum and that there's some decent percentages there of possibilities. As far as the hopeless crowd, I just don't know.
Okay, all right, but I just want people out there to have an idea because you work with this and what you think. Tom.
Well, I want to ask Brad a question about that.
Go ahead.
When we break it out into its component parts and say how much support is there for substance abuse treatment instead of incarceration. I know states are spending a lot on incarceration. How much support is there for mental health services and supportive housing for people with mental health disabilities? How much support is there for job retraining so that workers who earn too little to afford housing can get housing? I don't think we can look at the Bring America Home Act and say, well, we've got 12% supporting solving this. If we look at the different components, I think at different places we have stronger support than that.
I think that's what Brad was saying, as I understood it.
Yeah, I think that I think that's a good point. I mean, the Bringing America Home isn't the only track. It isn't the only solution. It's just one way to measure the level of support for a comprehensive solution. But you're absolutely right that there's different component parts and levels of support. Different entry points for people.
Okay, I want to try and quickly get in a couple of calls. We've got Gordon on the line, I think from Los Angeles. Gordon, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here, but it's not Los Angeles. It's Auburn, California.
Oh, sorry. Okay, Gordon, we haven't got much time. What do you want to say?
Well, I think one of the biggies, like you were talking about, was the mental health issues. I was homelessly mentally ill. I qualified under the AB 2034 program. And what they do is they go ahead and take people, the mentally ill homeless, they go ahead and they put them in group homes. A lot of group homes, they have the conditions about being in the mentally ill. If you don't qualify as mentally ill, then they'll go ahead and they'll say you don't qualify and you can't be in the house. Well, recently, in the place where I'm at right now, one of the clients was told that she didn't qualify at all as being mentally ill. stress her out so bad she's down in the pump unit right now. Been down there for, what, the whole weekend. I said they're going to keep her for another 3 days besides that. We didn't know where she was. They didn't tell any of us here. We, you know, we all, it's just concerns about the other people in the house. We're talking suicidal, okay?
So you're living inside a facility right now?
Excuse me?
You're calling from inside a facility?
Oh, hell yeah, I am. I'm right here.
Okay. And you feel that you're not well treated?
Oh, no, hey, I'm all right. I'm pretty sharp. I got a little brain here. There's there's a part now with the new prop initiative that was just passed in the last elections where they actually want to start helping some of the homeless people and the mentally ill start working as peer counselors, mentors. Matter of fact, the woman I'm talking about, she was in the mentor program here at the Placer County Adult Systems of Care program. And they said that she wouldn't qualify. And they put so much pressure on her and stressed her out to the fact that they're going to kick her out and make her homeless again that she is now in the PUF unit. And they jeopardized her health. And when doing so,
let me get this straight.
To the rest of the people.
Are you saying, Gordon, that they can coerce people into different levels of treatment by simply threatening to make them go outside and be homeless again?
Well, what happened here is they said she didn't qualify, that her illness wasn't serious enough. In fact, she's trying to be a mentor in the program, and she showed some sort of initiative. They said, go out and get a job. So they offered her a job working for $3.85 an hour, and there is no way that she's going to be able to pay rent anywhere else.
Right. Got it. Thank you very much, Gordon. I want to thank you very much for the call. We're almost out of time.
All right. Good
thank
program.
You so much. Thank you. Tom, I want to ask you a question, because I was asking Brad about the percentages in Congress. I don't think you can break this down into percentages, but as an activist, how effective can we be as activists? If somebody was to come to you and say, Tom, if I want to make change, what chance do I have of doing it by participating in building takeovers and squatting and all of that? What would you say?
Actually, we've had a pretty good record here. I can go back to San Francisco in 2001. We took over 170 Fell Street. We demanded to be put in the surplus property inventory. It was owned by the Department of Education, unused for more than a decade. We coordinated that with Councilmember Chris Daly, or Supervisor Chris Daly in San Francisco. He introduced legislation to turn over surplus property. At the same time, we did the action. It dramatized things. That legislation passed. Here, we did the direct action at the Franklin School 2 years ago. After 17 years of being unused, that was used. Of course, the squatters movement, the direct takeover of 22 buildings, and despite Giuliani attacking them with a tank, 11 buildings now in the possession of people. Recently, with the series of demonstrations over the Randall School, we saw the mayor pressured to reopen the Gale School. So even if it's not the top issue at the Congress, go to any major city in America and ask voters at the municipal level what the big issues are in their community, and homelessness ranks at or near the top in every big city in America.
Okay, let me stop you. We're down to 30 seconds, and I'm going to ask you each the same question. Starting with you, Tom, what can people listening do to help activists, to help people like you? 10 seconds.
Attend these hearings, especially if you have time. You can pull up your city council's hearing schedule, and you can go. You can make your voice heard, and you can let your elected leaders know that you want services to continue.
Okay. And Brad, people want to support your legislative efforts. What can they do?
They can call and write their congressmen and senators, ask them to support the National Housing Trust Fund, the Bringing America Home Act, and returning of adequate funding to the HUD budget.
Brad Paul, Director, National Policy and Advocacy Council on Homelessness, and Tom Gomez, co-founder at Mayday DC, thank you both for being my co-hosts.
Thank you very much.
And we'll be back after a break.
You are listening to the 8th Annual Homelessness Marathon, produced in conjunction with WPKN Community Radio in Bridgeport, Connecticut. The opinions expressed on this broadcast are not necessarily those of the producing or participating organizations or of the originating or affiliated radio stations. To view the webcast of this broadcast, order tapes, or contact Nobody after the show, go to www.homelessnessmarathon.org. It's